The title of the research paper, like most scientific research papers, is dry, lacking any pretense of hyperbole, fantasy, or self-promotion. Title designed to convey to fellow scientists that inside are the author's attempts to state just the facts. A title that might instantly put a non-scientist to sleep. The anatomy of a large-scale hypertextual web search engine is today known mostly to computer scientists and interested business historians. But the name of the company described in the paper and formed to implement the paper's concepts is now one of the most recognized words on the planet. Right off the bat, in the paper's opening abstract, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, at the time two computer science doctoral candidates at Stanford University, announce, "In this paper, we present Google, a prototype of a large-scale search engine which makes heavy use of the structure present in hypertext. Google is designed to crawl and index the web efficiently and produce much more satisfying search results than existing systems." So there it is, a brief statement of both the problem and the solution. The problem: existing systems are deficient, lacking, unsatisfying, and inefficient. And the solution: an industrial-strength search engine that efficiently utilizes existing internet system design. As Page and Brin identified in 1997, human-maintained lists cover popular topics effectively, but are subjective, expensive to build and maintain, slow to improve, and cannot cover all esoteric topics. Automated search engines that rely on keyword matching usually return too many low-quality matches. To make matters worse, some advertisers attempt to gain people's attention by taking measures meant to mislead automated search engines. So the task that the two set for themselves was to make an automated search engine that returned high-quality matches and could not be easily fooled by people attempting to game the system. Their great innovation, like most great solutions, seems blindingly obvious in hindsight. They created a results ranking system that they named PageRank, and they explained in the paper how it worked. A page can have a high PageRank if there are many pages that point to it, or if there are some pages that point to it and have themselves a high PageRank. Intuitively, pages that are well cited from many places around the web are worth looking at. So, rather than themselves as humans trying to decide what results to return to a user search, and rather than using metrics like page hits that were flawed or susceptible to tampering, Page and Brin had the insight that the way to rank popularity of web pages was to simply count the number of links referring to it from other pages, and that this information was available within the pages themselves and could be discovered by crawling all over the web to discover the links. While this insight was thrillingly simple, it was another thing for Page and Brin to actually engineer a system that could put PageRank into production so that a user could search the web. As they wrote, "Creating a search engine which scales even to today's web presents many challenges. Fast crawling technology is needed to gather the web documents and keep them up to date. Storage space must be used efficiently to store indices and, optionally, the documents themselves. The indexing system must process hundreds of gigabytes of data efficiently. Queries must be handled quickly, at a rate of hundreds to thousands per second." And yet they set out to produce just such a system. Indeed, they produced a system, as doctoral students at Stanford, that would do exactly these things. At the end of the paper, they evaluate their system. They wrote, "The most important measure of a search engine is the quality of its search results. While a complete user evaluation is beyond the scope of this paper, our own experience with Google has shown it to produce better results than the major commercial search engines for most searches. As an example, which illustrates the use of PageRank, Figure 4 shows Google's results for a search on Bill Clinton. A number of results are from the WhiteHouse.gov domain, which is what one may reasonably expect from such a search. Currently, most major commercial search engines do not return any results from WhiteHouse.gov, much less the right ones. All of the results are reasonably high-quality pages, and at last check, none were broken links. This is largely because they all have high PageRank. Finally, there are no results about a bill other than Clinton, or about a Clinton other than Bill. Of course, a true test of the quality of a search engine would involve an extensive user study or results analysis, which we do not have room for here. Instead, we invite the reader to try Google for themselves at http://google.stanford.edu. It is breathtaking to read through this paper, with some of its clunky syntax and misspellings, its original home on the campus of Stanford, and realize that you are reading the description of the work that forms the basis for one of the world's great companies. People all over the world took up Page and Brin's invitation to visit Google, and they found the search results delivered by the system to be superior to others. Google added an advertising component so that the company could get paid, and eventually Google went public and offered its shares to anyone who wished to buy them. The rise in the price of Google stock is the main way that people think about its creation of wealth. Since going public at $86 a share, the stock now trades at $693 per share, an eightfold increase. But this perspective doesn't really convey the astounding creation of capital that Google represents. Instead, consider the rise in the value of the company as a whole. 10 years ago, Google consisted of the breakthrough PageRank idea of two university students. A mere decade later, the world's most public stock market places a value on Google of $216 billion, making it among the top 10 most valuable companies in the United States. Google is believed to possess the world's largest private computer data center and network in the world, still doing what Page and Brin were doing on the Stanford campus a decade ago, crawling, indexing, storing, and responding to users of the ever-growing web. In short, Google represents one of the greatest and fastest, if not the greatest and fastest, return on investment capital ever, a 13-fold increase in the market value of invested capital in two handfuls of years. As I write this monologue, bringing home to me the startling and rapid rise in the fortunes of Google is the fact that I am using Microsoft Word 2000, and one word consistently comes up as being unrecognized by the spell checker, the word Google, underlined with a red squiggly line suggesting its unfamiliarity. I think it is safe to say that though Microsoft did not recognize Google in 2000, it surely does now. To this day, Larry Page and Sergey Brin's PageRank system remains the core of Google's value, presenting a quasi-democratic ranking of results to web queries. And while Google gets paid extraordinarily well for the ad listings that it places around the search results, it does not take a penny in payment for the search results themselves. In fact, one way I know that this radio show is reaching increasingly more people is that the Google PageRank of our website has gone from non-existent to zero, to one, and recently to two. While it's not exactly Google-type growth, I promise that you listeners will be the first to know the day that we reach 10, the highest page rank possible. Google represents an enormous increase in the store of human knowledge capital. For the most part, however, it is not creating additional information and knowledge. It is organizing, prioritizing, and making more accessible existing knowledge. For that function alone, it is extraordinarily profitable. What Google does with its profits is, of course, of interest to its shareholders. Corporate managements have a handful of things they can do with profit. They can pay dividends to shareholders. They can buy back stock shares. They can acquire other companies, or they can reinvest in their own business. On Tuesday, November 27th, 2 days ago, Google announced a new set of investments, though these seemingly have little to do with the internet search and advertising business, and might therefore give its shareholders pause for concern that management is forgetting its main business. A new initiative called RE less than C was released with a public document that announces, "Clean and affordable energy is a growing need for our company, so we're excited about launching RE less than C, a strategic initiative whose mission is to develop electricity from renewable resources cheaper than electricity produced from coal. Initially, this project to create renewable energy cheaper than coal will focus on advanced solar power, wind power technologies, and enhanced geothermal systems, but we'll explore other potential breakthrough technologies too. We're busy assembling our own internal research and development group and hiring a team of engineers and energy experts tasked with building 1 gigawatt of renewable energy capacity that is cheaper than coal. That's enough electricity to power a city the size of San Francisco. Google's R&D effort will begin with a significant effort on solar thermal technology and will also investigate enhanced geothermal systems and other areas. There is a video, available of course on Google, of Larry Page and Sergey Brin addressing a large technology conference from a couple of years ago. One of the most astounding and impressive things that they show on the presentation screen on stage behind them is a dynamic display of a spinning globe of the Earth. It is dynamic because where Google is currently, at that very second in heavy use, stacks of lighted dots pile up and emanate from that location. What results is a graphical dashboard of Google use worldwide. As Page and Brin spoke, you could see vast rays of light emanating from North America, Europe, parts of Asia, a literal enlightenment in wealthy and developing parts of the world. And as the globe spun, you could see that other areas, such as Africa, remained dark. The Wall Street Journal notes in its article on the new Google Energy Initiative that Google co-founder Sergey Brin said the company will encourage its partners to license their technology for modest sums to encourage rapid deployment and bring electricity to parts of the world that don't have it now, roughly 1.6 billion people, or 24.5% of the world's population in 2005. "We don't feel like we need to own every piece of the technology," Mr. Brin said. "We want the problem solved." Sergey Brin, as he himself will tell you, has a self-interest in bringing power to powerless parts of the world. Where there is power, there are computers. And where there are computers, there are Google users. Still, I believe the wider implications of the entire Google history and its newest press release are clear. There is nothing wrong with coal. There is something very wrong with the way we use it. There is nothing wrong with making automobiles. There is something very wrong with the automobiles that we make. There is nothing wrong with using resources for our needs. There is something very wrong with the way we use those resources. There is nothing wrong with a democracy that preserves individual liberty, but there is something wrong with a democracy that preserves individual liberty without any corresponding preservation of the common good. There is nothing wrong with public education or public health. There is something very wrong with what we have done to these vital institutions. In these and in so many other cases, our existing systems are deficient, lacking, unsatisfying, inefficient, and all too often polluting and degrading. In 1997, two young men, Larry Page, the son of a computer science professor, and Sergey Brin, the Russian immigrant son of a mathematics professor, looked around at the young World Wide Web and the search engines that had sprung up to try to make sense of it for people. They found that there was nothing wrong with the World Wide Web and its underlying hypertext protocol, and that there was nothing wrong with the idea of a search engine. What they found was something very wrong with the way the existing search engines were designed, and they wanted the problem solved. And the rest, as they say, is history. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show. Back in a moment.
You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.
Back to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. This is 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas, KPFT. Broadcasting to you as well on www.newcapitalshow.com, available as a podcast on iTunes or directly from newcapitalshow.com. You can send me email from newcapitalshow.com. You can post messages in the forum. You can link as well to several of the sources that I cited today on the piece on Google. We'll be linking to that original Stanford paper put out by Larry Page and Sergey Brin. We'll be linking to Google's new renewable energy announcement. We'll also link to the video that I talked about, this video in which this globe is spinning behind them. It's a fascinating story, and to me it's amazing. As much focus as there was in the 1990s on the World Wide Web and on search engines, and the incredible resources and programming resources that existed in larger companies at the time, like Microsoft, and of course Yahoo was going, other search engines, Alta Vista. It's incredible that as late, really, as 1997, that these two guys came up with a search technology far better than others, and that they've gone on to make such an incredible business, and as I say, build enormous amounts of human knowledge capital. That's really been the theme of the past 2 weeks. Last week I talked about the Kindle, the new ebook reader by Amazon that's being put out by Amazon, which actually has sold very, very well. I think that it's sold out in their backlog through the beginning of December, and so for Amazon that's a good sign. I talked about the amazing possibility that a popular ebook reader has to disseminate the library of the world, put it into human hands quickly, and provide information. We're truly living in amazing times where information is available to us. Of course, the problem all too often is that we don't avail ourselves to information. We shut ourselves off to information. We had several conversations, and I'd be happy to continue those conversations that several callers were providing last week. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, I guess, as we spend a couple of weeks talking about human knowledge capital. One thing I don't have an answer to that one caller, I don't remember who it was, last week brought up was, you know, what happens to redundancy of information if suddenly all the books are stored in one server with a few backup tapes somewhere up in Seattle, Washington? And, you know, how do we make sure that the information of the world continues to be available in a digital world? We become very vulnerable if paper books are not there. And I don't have an answer for that. Maybe somebody's got an answer. 713-526-5738. Talking about Amazon and its distribution of the world's library onto a single tablet, electronic tablet. And this week discussing the story of Google, which continues to be an amazing story. I don't think I know anybody who doesn't use Google. Google provides information to me on a regular basis, all the way from how do I care for a chainsaw wound? What's the proper safety equipment to use when operating a chainsaw? How do you make a better radio show? All these things are accessible in a way that they were not accessible 10 years ago. A few news items let's get to. Brazil's sugarcane ethanol gets a boost from IMF report. We've talked about this issue several times, many times on the show. And the differences in ethanol. And there are several articles now circulating around about the bloom being off the rose on corn ethanol here in the U.S. First of all, the competition with food supply when we use corn ethanol. When we use corn to produce ethanol, we're taking corn that could otherwise be used in the food supply. And then the fact that corn ethanol is far less efficient than sugarcane ethanol. This actually goes back to October 18th, this news item. This is Wall Street Journal. Brazil's sugarcane-based ethanol is the only form of ethanol that is generally cheaper to produce than gasoline, according to an International Monetary Fund analysis, boosting Brazil's plans to make itself a fuel powerhouse and undermining U.S. corn growers' efforts to present themselves as price competitive. Many of you have called into the show and made this point, that when you add in all of the costs, which we always try to do here on the New Capital Show, when you add in all of the costs of corn ethanol, the production inputs, transportation inputs, and so forth, corn ethanol turns out to be uneconomic versus gasoline. And in fact, sugarcane, because of the superior energy stored in sugarcane than in corn, is actually the only form of ethanol that is energy efficient. This analysis, part of the IMF semi-annual World Economic Outlook, also said none of the current crop of biodiesels can compete on price with conventional diesel, except perhaps for a biodiesel being developed from India's drought-resistant jatropha tree. The report is likely to exacerbate the food versus fuel debate, which pits ethanol supporters against development experts and many in the food industry who complain that using grains for fuel has played a role in increasing the price of staples such as meat and cereal. What's fascinating is what's going on as we see oil prices push toward $100 a barrel. This show began 5 years ago in which I said, you want to make some changes? You want to get some change going in the energy consumption profile of this country? Get the price of gasoline up. And at the time, I suggested that the government place what in retrospect would have been a modest tax. Oil at the time was probably trading at $30 a barrel, even $20 a barrel. If you think back to 1998, 1997, oil was at $10 a barrel. $10 a barrel in 1997. This is extraordinary to think. A tenfold increase almost a Google-like increase. So Google has increased its capital 13-fold, and of course oil's gone from 10 up to close to 100. So that just to give you some perspective on the price increase that has taken place in a barrel of oil, it's almost Google-like. And at the time I suggested that the government should undertake to place a modest tax. Modest. And of course, all the politicians at the time, and they still do, they say, oh, well, this would be political suicide. This would be political suicide for us to put a tax on it. And I've said all along, you know, politicians treat the people like infants, like we wouldn't understand. And it's terrible the way politicians do that. All they would have to say to us is I propose to place a tax on oil, and here is why. Here is what the proceeds will go to. What we've gone through, my friends, is a couple of decades of an all-out effort by the Republican Party and the conservative movement to make the very word tax a bad word in any form. You know, we have a country. We're supposed to be patriots of the country, the notion of country, and yet a tax which represents an effort to finance efforts for the common good, the very financing effort they've made into a bad word. And as a result, politicians across the political spectrum have become hamstrung to be able to make recommendations that they honestly and truly believe would be in the best interests, in the best common interests. And my friends, we're coming out of that period now. People now realize that there's no free lunch, that we can't finance things that need to be financed if we don't finance them. And that oftentimes the bigger issue than is there a tax is what is the project that we're proposing to finance. The projects that we could have financed over the past couple of decades in the realm of energy, we could have come out with amazing and incredible results. And yet here we are, still waiting, while two graduates of Stanford doctoral program, 10 years out, are being looked to in many ways as the primary financiers of alternative energy and alternative resources in this country. Totally unacceptable. Danger at sea. This is from a couple of days ago. Again, Wall Street Journal. Ships draw fire for rising role in air pollution. Bruce Stanley of Wall Street Journal reports, and as air pollution rises on the global political agenda, pressure is mounting on a largely hidden and proliferating source of dangerous emissions, the shipping industry. The corpuscles of the global economy, ships carry more than 90% of the world's merchandise by volume. Think about that. Ships, 90% of the world's merchandise is transported in the world by ship. And the tonnage of cargo sent by ships has tripled since 1970. Yet the fuel propelling them is cheap and dirty and produces an especially noxious exhaust. Ships release more sulfur dioxide, that's so-called SOx, a sooty pollutant associated with acid rain, than all of the world's cars, trucks, and buses combined. Let me read that to you again. Ships release more sulfur dioxide, a sooty pollutant associated with acid rain, than all of the world's cars, trucks, and buses combined, according to a March study by the International Council on Clean Transportation. I don't know. Never heard of that group, but we're going to assume that their numbers are good until proven otherwise. That study also found that ships produced an estimated 27% of the world's smog-causing nitrogen oxide emissions in 2005. Only 6 countries in the world emitted more greenhouse gases, which trap heat in the atmosphere, warming the globe, than was produced collectively in 2001 by all the ships larger than 100 tons. So there it is. If you take all ships larger than 100 tons, that becomes equivalent to the 7th largest polluting nation in the world, all the ships, according to the study and United Nations statistics. The global shipping industry is mired in an internal struggle over how to cope with its emissions problems, and no simple strategies have emerged for regulating the open seas. But demands for solutions are intensifying. Here we go. Who's going to come to the rescue? Of course, our friends in the great state of California. Assertive governments in a few ports that wield substantial commercial power are proving that local action can reverberate internationally. Since January 1 of this year, 2007, the state of California has required ships sailing within 24 miles of its shores to use cleaner burning fuels in their auxiliary engines. Similar to a 2005 measure governing Europe's Baltic Sea region, the California law restricts access to America's two largest ports, Los Angeles Port and Long Beach Port. Ships that don't comply can be fined or impounded. We're trying to get the city or the Port of Houston to come on the show and talk about their feelings about this pollutant. The article goes on to talk about this fuel that's used. It's called bunker fuel. First I've heard of it. I don't know anything about shipping. The big culprit is the industry's favorite fuel. It's called bunker fuel. Bunker fuel is a tar-like sludge left over from the refining of petroleum. It often contains toxic heavy metals such as lead and vanadium and is collected from the bottoms of the distillation towers in which refineries process crude. Raw, unheated bunker fuel has the composition and consistency of asphalt. Okay, so that's what ships are burning to get them locomotion. That's what propels ships across the world, burning asphalt. Says Klaus Jensen, the fleet manager at Torm, a shipping company based in Copenhagen. You can walk on it. It also is cheap. A recent spot price for intermediate-grade bunker fuel traded in Singapore averaged $505 a metric ton. It's less than two-thirds the rate of marine gas oil, a distillate similar to what diesel trucks use. Anyway, those of you listening to the New Capital Show, those of you who listen to KPFT in Pacifica, we've got another thing to think about. What ships are burning, and that comes to us courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. I know the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, it's not my favorite either, but some of the reporters working for the Wall Street Journal, as I like to tell people, are doing extraordinary work to bring us what, in my opinion, is certainly one of the major stories of our time, which is the ongoing destruction of the world's environment and the coming to consciousness of the people of the world to the many ways in which we do that. And it's incredible the more and more that we learn every day, and we can't talk about it too much in the media. We simply can't. We can't bring this information to your attention too much. The story of the destruction of species that is going on. And very often these stories are stories that come from our own homes, our own lives, the way that we transport ourselves in automobiles, the fuels that we burn to heat our homes and to light our homes and to bring us power and energy. The way that our products come to us from across the ocean is now a story that we've managed to get out over the air here on the New Capital Show. The fact that the fuel that is used in the ships that propel the transport of goods across the globe is asphalt and produces very large amounts of sulfur dioxide. 713-526-5738 is the number. We're talking about human capital and any other subject that you might want to be talking about. This is a fascinating story. This is out of Chicago. November 26, New York Times. In miles of alleys, Chicago finds its next environmental frontier. You know what? The other story that we're finding is that cities in this country and cities across the world are taking the lead in remediating their own environmental problems. We're finding that mayors and cities are among our greatest advocates and the greatest public servants in moving to make the world cleaner. And certainly that story is coming out of Chicago. Mayor Richard Daley there has made a pledge to make Chicago a very environmental city. It says, if this were any other city, perhaps it would not matter what kind of roadway was underfoot in the back alleys around town. But with nearly 2,000 miles of small service streets bisecting blocks from the north side to the south side, Chicago is the alley capital of America. In its alleys, city officials say, it has the paved equivalent of 5 mid-size airports. Let me say that again. Chicago's alleys constitute the paved equivalent of 5 mid-size airports. Part of the landscape since the city began, the alleys, mostly home to garbage bins and garages, make for cleaner and less congested main streets. But Chicago's distinction is not without disadvantages. Imagine having a duplicate set of streets in miniature to maintain that are prone to flooding and to dumping runoff into a strained sewer system. Right? I mean, basically Chicago has 2 sets of streets. The ones that sit in front of the houses and the ones that sit in back of the houses, the alleyways. So, and so imagine, you know, here in Houston, we have so many roads and we have flooding problems and we have runoff problems on our streets. Imagine if you had a duplicate set of streets in your cities. Well, that's exactly what the city of Chicago has. 2 sets of streets. Therefore, what is an old alley-laden city to do? Who had any idea? I had no idea. I had no clue. Here's an environmental problem. Chicago's alleyways. Chicago has decided to retrofit its alleys with environmentally sustainable road building materials under its Green Alley Initiative. Something experts say is among the most ambitious public street makeover plans in the country. In a larger sense, the city is rethinking the way it paves things. In a green alley, water is allowed to penetrate the soil through the pavement itself, which consists of the relatively new but little used technology of permeable concrete or porous asphalt. Then the water, filtered through stone beds under the permeable surface layer, recharges the underground water table instead of ending up as polluted runoff in rivers and streams. Some of that water may end up back in Lake Michigan, from which Chicago takes a billion gallons a year. Says Janet Atarian, the project's director, the question is, if you've got to resurface an alley anyway, can you make it do more for you? This is an amazing story. And there are going to be fortunes made. Companies that are going to be coming up with permeable paving materials that can be used to produce green alleyways. This is new capital, my friends, and this is what's going on when the country, when the cities, when the states become environmentally conscious. We create new industries. We improve our environments. We create vast new capital, huge returns on investment. This is the way that our federal government, under its leadership, regardless of whether that was Republican or Democratic, should have been going for the past couple of decades. Now we find ourselves as a country in a place with mortgage crises, debt crises. Debt crises that indebt us to other countries, indebt people to financial services organizations, obligations they can't handle, in many cases to hospitals. This country is known for its innovation, and yet our public policies have set up situations where innovation is difficult to achieve. That's changing. And it's changing most rapidly at the local level. As the city of Chicago decides that it's going to repave all of its alleyways, an entire second set of streets, as I say, you will find businesses that are born, that innovate, and that prosper, meeting the needs of a new and greener environmental world. 713-526-5738 is the number, 713-526-KPFT here at the New Capital Show. Finally, I'd like to get to a piece that I've been meaning to get to for several weeks and I wanted to get to during Pledge Drive. We had the guys, actually one guy, his name is Karsten Henningsen. He's a portfolio manager at Portfolio 21, which is a mutual fund complex. I think they're based in Seattle. And they practice socially responsible investing. They were on a show way back, I think it was back in March of this year, but we did a show on socially responsible investing. And Carsten Henningsen and his colleague, Leslie Christian, another portfolio manager, you know, these funds issue reports regularly throughout the year, semi-annual report, annual report. This is a report for the year ended June 30th, 2007. That's their fiscal reporting year for the mutual fund. And they wrote what I regard as an incredible and remarkable piece talking about sustainability. And to me, it was a very frank discussion about what sustainable investing is capable of and what it's not capable of. And I was so impressed with it, I'd like to share it with you. It says, since the inception of Portfolio 21 in 1999, we have struggled with the term sustainability. Our definition was provided, by one of our advisors, as well as by other progressive economists. We define sustainability as securing people's quality of life within the means of nature. Again, this is the definition of the portfolio managers at Portfolio 21. They define sustainability as securing people's quality of life within the means of nature. Talk about inconvenient truths. They say the truth is that sustainability places limits on us. Since our natural systems are finite, we cannot live within the means of nature if we insist upon relentless physical growth. We are currently using natural resources and services at a rate that is equivalent to a 25% overdraft or deficit. That is, we are dipping into our natural capital faster than it can renew itself. Since we currently have no way to borrow natural capital from another planet, galaxy, or universe, it seems obvious that the only way to live within the means of nature is to use less. A popular notion is that we can have growth without using more natural capital. Some refer to this as sustainable development, the idea that we are a knowledge economy and that we can dematerialize while still improving the quality of life. This is indeed an attractive scenario, and there are many, many examples of governments, companies, and individuals that have made progress in this area. But when we look at the big picture, the trend is still inconvenient. Modern industrial economies, no matter how high-tech, are carbon-based economies, and their predominant activity is burning material. The atmosphere is now the biggest dumping ground for the processed output flows of industrial economies, and the atmosphere is full. Unfortunately, the concept of cutting back is unattractive to most people. Remember, I'm reading to you the annual report of an investment manager in the capitalist world of America, and they are talking about the notion of cutting back. Unfortunately, the concept of cutting back is unattractive to most people. Not only is it interpreted as an infringement on personal freedom, but it highlights the fact that humans are not all-powerful. We cannot manufacture or invent natural capital. Cutting back is not attractive to U.S. politicians either. And those who understand the financial system know that it depends upon growth to fund the interest payments on all the debt we have accumulated. Introducing the concept in reality of biocapacity limits into an economic system that has prided itself on its ability to generate seemingly unlimited growth is indeed awkward. Rather than embracing biocapacity limits as an exhilarating challenge and opportunity for renewal, the economic establishment engages in financial one-upsmanship. It is not uncommon for people who raise the issue of biocapacity limits to be labeled naive and negative, rather than realistic and honest. This refusal to accept limitations has contributed to the willingness of the press, the financial community, and government to avoid the hard task of defining sustainability in a meaningful way. The reality of sustainability is just not compatible with our global growth mentality. At Portfolio 21, when we use the term sustainability in conjunction with investing in the global economy via publicly traded stocks, we are careful to include two big caveats. One, we are referring to environmental sustainability, and two, we are skeptical that any publicly traded corporation is sustainable. I find this to be an amazing document. A frank admission by portfolio managers investing in publicly traded corporations that, as they say, they are skeptical that any publicly traded corporation is sustainable. They go on to say, to the extent that it can realize better margins through environmental measures, a company will do so because there is a compelling financial case. It is much less likely that the global economic system in the aggregate can or will deal with social inequities. Thus, in the global economy, we believe we can identify companies that are incorporating environmental sustainability into their business strategies. But we do not claim that we are investing in sustainable companies because we do not believe that is what we are doing. We are managing ecological risk in investment portfolios by applying rigorous environmental sustainability criteria to companies. We believe we owe it to you, our shareholders, to be honest, to speak the truth as we know it. We cannot in good conscience pretend that we are engaged in sustainable investing. To the extent that you and we choose to invest in the global economy, we believe our investment strategy is positioned to provide competitive returns and that the companies in the portfolio are better equipped to deal with the inconvenient truth and limitations of sustainability better than those that are choosing to believe in a more convenient fantasy of unlimited biocapacity. Sincerely, Leslie Christian and Carsten Henningsen, both co-founders of Portfolio 21. My friends, I'm at least happy to see that there are portfolio managers willing to face these inconvenient truths. I think that solutions begin with discussions. It is a bit depressing to me to hear their belief that sustainability is not possible and that that all depends upon unfettered growth. I think that we all need to think about how we can form a better world for the future that is not totally dependent upon increased consumption of natural capital. Google, I think, is an amazing story because, in fact, it has produced enormous wealth, built enormous amounts of capital without significant use of natural capital, and in that sense is a model. Of course, it is a part of the information economy, but it seems to me that there are ways to provide greater returns on capital and preserve natural capital, and I've tried to highlight for you the story on the alleyways of Chicago as one way that we can do that. It may be that we're going to continue to pave streets, but there may be smarter ways that we can pave streets. There must be smarter ways that we can do all of these things. We've got just a few minutes left. Let's go to the phones. Rick has been holding. Rick, welcome to New Capital Show.
Yes, thank you. There was one thing that I did see. There was an innovation coming out of Denmark that I saw in the Austin Chronicle this Thanksgiving holiday. I saw that ships now, or Denmark company, is making huge kites similar to sails that they send up on these cargo ships that are like a football field long, that they send up, 1,000 feet in the air, and they alleviate the fuel consumption by using wind to, push them across, across the ocean. And I just thought that was fascinating that we're actually going back to a previous technology. Hundreds of years.
Rick, that's great. I mean, in so many ways, that is, and Rick, thanks for your call. In so many ways, what we do in going forward may be a function of looking back at where we've come from. Sail power has worked for millennia in helping humans get across the water, large bodies of water. And it may be that sail power is what we need to go right back to be able to transport goods across the oceans again. Next up, let's take Monica. Monica, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, Leo. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
And I have a question, and I should say in advance, I don't mean to be inappropriate here, so if I am, I apologize, and you tell me that I am, and I'll hang up and go away.
Okay.
But I was trying to find out, you are an investment advisor?
Yes.
You're not a portfolio manager.
Are you asking the difference?
Well, I'm asking, what do you do?
Well, let me just ask this. What is the direction of your call, Monica? Because I don't want to sit and advertise for what I do. That's not what I do here on the show.
Yeah, I know. That's why I thought you might hang up on me.
But are you struggling to know the difference between these things and the financial industry? What is it that?
Yeah. What is the difference between what you do and a portfolio manager?
Okay. Let me hang up here and let me see if I can help describe that very briefly. Okay.
Okay. And the other thing I wanted to say, I know a while back on one of the pledge drives you offered your services as one of the promos.
Yes.
And I was hoping that you would do that again.
Well, Monica, thank you, and we'll think about it. We found out later there may be some issues. We try to address these issues, but why don't you send me an email later, and we'll see if maybe the station would be willing to take you up on that, okay?
And I would just go to the New Capital Show website.
Go to newcapitalshow.com, and you can reach me from there.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Monica.
Thank you.
There are different functions in the management of investments. Financial advisors tend to deal one-on-one with clients and to help them arrange portfolios. They're not generally in the practice of picking individual securities to go into portfolios. Rather, they're using other instruments, generally mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, but generally funds. A portfolio manager, on the other hand, tends to be the person who actually runs those funds. And the reason that the industry tends to segment in this way is for efficiency. If somebody is trying to sit down and work with an individual client to understand what their personal needs are, it's very hard to get the time to analyze individual securities for construction of portfolios. And so it used to be that way. It used to be that stockbrokers, and it still is that way in many places, where stockbrokers will try to put individuals into individual securities. But I think that it's been proven pretty much that results are far better when financial advisors, financial planners, work directly with individuals to focus on their needs and to help assemble a portfolio for the client using funds. And then portfolio managers themselves are the people who put together those funds. So one of the jobs of the financial advisor is to find good portfolio managers, and the job of good portfolio managers is to find good securities, however you define good. Good may be socially responsible funds or socially responsible companies, or it may be companies engaged in particular that have particular advantages in business, company like Google, for example, and so forth. So I hope that answers the question. It's kind of a hierarchy, a family tree of being able to provide financial services. If you've got any questions about that, feel free to email me, and you can reach me through newcapitalshow.com. Next, let's take Isabel. Isabel, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you. I was actually calling to get your email to send you some an idea ahead.
Okay.
This is a little bit of an unorthodox way of looking at this. We're looking at sustainability from all the outside products in terms of what we can use, what we can, less this and that. But the one thing that's been we're not devoting as a global is sustainability of the human being into empowerment, into self-sufficiency, and into building. Because what you look at is now building more and more from outside and the money and all that, but who's extractable has been the people. Look at America, where it's going, mm-hmm. where other societies are going. But in ancient times, you know, as you said, like individual sitting down and counseling, the communities building, going back to the grassroots, the limit of outside, what we see, is hit almost to the top, to a point where we're getting destructive. But the thing is, if we put it back to people, and the thing is, if the humans are empowered, you're right, on our daily life, how we do, what we think, how we use, if we become more responsible, then that's what the energy, the positive energy that is going to be building around us.
Isabel, thank you for your comments. They're wonderful. May I follow up on them?
I'll send you an email.
Okay, thank you. Isabel's exactly right. In order to create a world with growing sustainable capital, we have to have healthy, enlightened, peaceful human beings. I mean, she has hit the nail on the head. And in order to have happy and healthy, peaceful, sustainable, enlightened human beings, you know, we have to start with ourselves. We have to start with ourselves. I can't start with you, and you can't start with me. We can have influence on each other, but ultimately, creating this extraordinary power in the world that I think we have the ability to create, to enhance all forms of capital in the world, natural capital, the capital of other species, human knowledge capital, financial capital, all of these things depend upon us working on ourselves. And when we point fingers at other people, and when we blame others, and when we think that our problems are coming from other people, we are part of the problem, not the solution. So I want to thank Isabel for that call. She is exactly right. And this is why beginning in a way with a spiritual capital is so important. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about the power to look within your own spirit and to recognize your kindredness with all other beings and all of the other things in the universe. Once you begin to do that and do it in a peaceful way, we will all be on our way. And that is the battle that we fight daily. We've got time for, I think, one more call. We're going to take Gordon. Gordon, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Listen, I was really just blown away thinking that these tankers are crisscrossing the globe, burning asphalt.
Yes.
Or stuff like that. I mean, this is the bottom of the barrel.
Gordon, literally, as the article indicates, it's the bottom of the refinery barrel.
But worse than that, what do you do with it if you don't burn it or do something with it?
I'm thinking the same thing. What do we do?
Then that leads me to something that maybe most people around Texas don't know about, some injection wells that they're going to put in here in Conroe, Texas.
Okay.
These injection wells will go through at least three different aquifers. And so that's Montgomery County. What do we worry about it here in Harris County? Well, these aquifers, they go through every county along the Gulf Coast from the waters in at least three counties.
Yes, it's a vast underground cave that's interconnected.
Absolutely. Now, you may not drink that water, but by God, you're going to be coming in contact with it. You're going to wash yourself, wash your produce, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
My point real quick is that go to www.stopthetoxicwells.com. For more information about this.
Mm-hmm.
StopTheToxicWells.com. They're having a meeting in Conroe at an elementary school this evening at 6:30. Please do something here in your own backyard that you can deal with, or we'll never get past the effects of what's going to happen if they put these wells in.
Gordon, thanks for the call.
Very welcome. Goodbye.
Thank you, Gordon. I don't have any answer for what happens to the bottom of the barrel asphalt if we don't burn it in the ships, but as I say, the ingenuity of humans is almost boundless, and I am sure that we can come up with something that is a sustainable use for the asphalt. Maybe some of you over the next week will think about what can we do with the asphalt rather than burning it in ships, and maybe some of you will go on to start a new business based on that. It's been a pleasure to be with you again for another edition of the New Capital Show. Thanks to Laura Slavin for her wonderful engineering. I'll be back with you next week. And as always, www.newcapitalshow.com is our website. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.